to the first episode of the Marvel Cinematic Podcast. I'm your host, Adam, and with me is my co-host, Ryan. Ryan, how's it going?
Well, you know, all things considering, I'm doing pretty good. And then I looked outside and there's snow on the ground.
Well, even Mother Nature is confused at this point.
Well, I made the joke, you know, after, you know, it sucks that it was a, well, whatever. In a badly timed joke after the tornadoes from earlier this week, I think, that Mother Nature's April 2020, you know, doomsday weapon is going to be weather. You know, because January was the threat of World War III. February was wildfires. March is the coronavirus. And now April is weather. So I'm terrified of what May is going to be.
Yeah, who knows?
I just hope that, like, you know, giant monsters are saved for, like, maybe later in the summer. I don't want to jump right into that.
Can I just hibernate until 2021? Is that an option?
I want to sleep for the rest of the year except on my birthday. And
yeah. Yeah, because there's no movies coming out, so what the hell? People may be wondering, you know, when I announced the title of the podcast, what the hell's going on? Some people are actually thinking, why are these two idiots doing another podcast? But the truth of the matter is, when Ryan and I first sat down and had a conversation, one of the ideas that we had discussed was doing a Marvel movie podcast. And then that morphed into superhero sci-fi, but we had bitten off more than we could chew with that one. So Ryan and I and buddy Steven and Travis were really focused in on the DC side of things. We still are, you know. Ryan is part of the Superman podcast, the Batman podcast, and all the other ones we do. But you know, I was talking with Ryan again, as I often do, and we were saying that, you know, since we are in self-mandatory isolation, and since you know, there's delays with the Marvel movies, why not take this opportunity to go back to one of our original intentions and start a Marvel movie podcast? And so here we are. We are going to endeavor to do most of the Marvel movies, not just the Marvel Cinematic Universe, though we are going to start with the Marvel Cinematic Universe because we figure there are how many movies so far?
Oh God, we gotta have like
23. All right, so
23 released films.
Right, so we figure we'll do one a month, and that should take us through this hopefully craziness. And we'll have newer movies to talk about after that point. But also, in between, when we get news of, like, let's say, you know, because the Fantastic Four are coming to the MCU. So once the announcement comes down of who's going to direct, who's going to write, who's going to star, we'll go back and review the Fantastic Four movies that have come before. We'll do the same for the X-Men and so on and so forth. But we're going to start things off with the MCU. And we're going to start from the beginning. So we are going all the way back to 2008 and the first Iron Man movie. But before we do that, Ryan, is there any news whatsoever to talk about regarding Marvel movies?
Well, simply put, because of this, because of Rona, this damn virus that's spread throughout the world, Hollywood and just the entertainment business as a whole has had to shut down for it's going on a month and a half now. Mm-hmm. And because, you know, nobody knows exactly when things will be, you know, safe enough for people to go back out and go shopping, go to the movies, go to comic book shops, or even start filming stuff for TV or movies. Mm-hmm. A lot of theaters have been completely shut down across the board. Read an article like a week or two ago that like there are only 14 movie theaters in the United States that are still open.
Wow.
13 of them are drive-ins. So it's like, of course, those can probably, you know, with the social distancing and everyone staying in their cars, that
as long as you stay in your cars and close the windows, yeah. you're good.
So because of that, because of everything going on, release dates for every movie, you know, not just, well, movies that were going to be released, you know, this spring and throughout the summer. A lot of fall and winter stuff has, for the most part, you know, stayed, because hopefully things will be calmer by then, I would say. Mm-hmm. So, like, in less than a month, we were supposed to get the Black Widow, you know, movie. Finally, we get to see a solo Natasha Romanoff film. Mm-hmm. But that got pushed back, and then that, of course, ended up kind of pushing back the entire Phase 4 Marvel slate. So about a week or so ago, when Marvel and Disney came out with the new release dates for all the movies, we have Black Widow being released now in November, November 6th of this year. Hopefully that far away, it'll, you know, be able to stay and, you know, things will be okay by then. Mm-hmm. The Eternals is now February 12th of 2021, followed by Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings on May 7th. MCU's Spider-Man 3 still seems to be scheduled for July 16th of next year, but I have an inkling that that might probably get pushed back because, you know, Tom Holland has said that they were going to start filming for that in the summer, and I'm not that confident that that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. We'll see, you know, hope for the best, plan for the worst.
Exactly.
Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness is scheduled for November 5th of 2021. Which, you know, little side note, officially confirmed, Sam Raimi's directing.
I'm excited about that.
He's coming back to Marvel. I love it.
I'm so excited about that, mm-hmm. because I still especially love those first two Sam Raimi movies.
Spider-Man movies, yep.
Yeah, and that's what I meant. And we reviewed those on the other show, which I might repost them. Mm-hmm. Rebrand and repost. Or, you know, Ryan and I can do the trilogy as a whole instead of a separate kind of thing. We'll do a retrospective. Which
I would have no problem revisiting those movies.
Well, okay, well, there we go. It's done, folks. At some point, we'll revisit those.
Followed by Thor, Love and mm-hmm. Thunder, February 18th of 2022, Black Panther 2, May 6th of 2022, and Captain Marvel 2, July 8th, 2022.
All right,
so. That's the only stuff that's, you know, been confirmed release dates that we don't know anything about yet for Guardians 3 or Blade, or the, you know, there was a, you know, one of the writers of Rick and Morty got hired for Ant-Man 3.
Mm-hmm.
So none of those have release dates, but.
Which right now puts them in a good position, because why do they need one at this point?
Exactly.
Yeah, so they're in good shape at this point. And they're probably, you know, you probably won't see those until late 2022, some of them, or 2023.
Yeah, the earliest would be like fall of 2022.
Right, so there's no point. There's no point in dating them that far out, especially considering what's going on. But you know what, those movies will come when it's, mm-hmm. when things have calmed down here, and we look forward to bringing you news and details as we have them on all of those movies. And then, of course, once we've gotten a chance to see them, we will review them as part of this here podcast. So we look forward to those days. But until we get there, we can have ourselves a look back. So why don't we Why don't we go back in the time machine back to 2008? I believe it was May, correct? I think.
Yeah. Let's first, go see. Yeah. May 2nd, 2028.
Yeah.
Oh my God, 2008. Right.
That'll be Iron Man 12 with his daughter.
Finally, Iron Man. Yeah. Iron Man 4, May 2nd, 2028.
Yeah, with Morgan Stark. I'd watch that actually. So yeah. Marvel, if that's what you want to do, go for it. Or Riri Williams as Ironheart, I don't care.
I kind of hope that they would go that route with Riri, but yeah.
Or have one in a Disney Plus kind of series, right?
Mm-hmm.
A Young Avengers type thing. Have Morgan in a Young Avengers type thing, and have Riri as Ironheart. There you go,
Ironheart.
That's called having your cake and eating it
too. Let's give. I think Rhodey, you know, has earned a solo War Machine.
Well, at this point, look. If Black Widow, almost a decade after her debut in the MCU, mm-hmm. can get a solo. Why can't Rhodey?
I just kind of find funny that the only member of the original Avengers who doesn't get his own movie, but he will get a series, but not a movie, is Hawkeye.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know what. Jeremy Renner's happy. He's got himself a series.
Exactly. I'm looking forward to it. You know, it'll be cool.
But come on, Don Cheadle, why don't you get out there and hashtag Borg Life? Somebody else does it. Mind you, that hasn't worked out that well for him, so you might not want to do that. I couldn't resist. I'm sorry. Ryan, I mean, before we sort of get into the nuts and bolts of our, you know, specifics, what were some of your thoughts going into the movie?
Oh God, I'm trying to remember so far back. I mean, I'll confess that through my dad, who was, you know, the big Marvel fanatic growing up, I had like tangentially known about Iron Man, but I didn't even know. Like, I knew that such a character existed, but I knew like almost practically nothing before, you know, trailers and whatnot. And this movie really did, you know, the trailers really did sell me.
Yeah.
On this thing, especially that first one with set to the Black Sabbath song. You know, I just always thought, you know, what do you want me to, like, general thoughts going in or coming out of the movie?
Going in.
I just remember, like, you know, before Iron Man, you know, my favorites were, you know, Batman, Spider-Man, X-Men, you know, Fantastic Four. This was still kind of before my comic book reading time.
Right.
But some of the first superhero comics I ever, like, picked up just to read were probably because of Iron Man.
Fair enough, yeah.
So.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it was kind of a scenario like I had heard the rumors online about, you know, Tom Cruise possibly playing Iron Man. And I think Nick Cassavetes or somebody like that was going to direct. And so I had heard that stuff online and I'm like, well, I mean, you know, I'm not one of those Tom Cruise haters, but I don't love everything he does either. So I'm like, well, I mean, it could work. I could kind of see it, you know, if he did like a Top Gun kind of vibe for Tony Stark. That never came to be. And then John Favreau came on board, and I know him from Elf. And so I like that movie, and I'm like, hey, it's Foggy from Daredevil directing the movie. All right, I can roll with this. Then they cast Robert Downey Jr. And I wasn't I honestly didn't know what to expect with that because, you know, he had had his issues and he was kind of sort of on the outs in Hollywood at the time. And it was actually a big, you know, Favreau had to fight for him. So that told you something. And so, yeah, I was intrigued, and I was so intrigued, in fact, that I went to the comic book store and I asked for something Iron Man that I could buy and read. And my comic guy gave me the Warren Ellis Extremis. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yes. Yeah.
So he gave me that, and I loved the story. I loved the art, and so I said, "All right, I'm intrigued. I'm interested." And then I went to the theater, and what a movie!
You got Extremis was your first. I know it didn't come out until like after the film came out, but do you remember an arc called The Five Nightmares?
I've heard of that.
Where Tony has to fight the son of Obadiah.
Yeah, that was from the Mad Fraction run, I think, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah, because I was collecting Iron Man at that point. Yeah.
That was the first. Yeah, it took a while after the movie, but that was the first Iron Man comic that I remember reading.
That art by Salvador La Roca is fantastic, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It's gorgeous. Yep.
Yeah. So,
although I do remember it being a little weird, like the armor's coming out of the skin. What the hell is this? Is nothing like the movie.
Yeah, which you would ultimately see later. Right, as he developed his armor, I forgot what number he's on in the movie or he was on. Oh, in the movies.
Yeah, I think by like Endgame it's like 50 or so. I don't know, but
yeah, he's had a lot of time to tinker. You know, in another universe, Tony Stark might have been called the Tinkerer. I didn't like that one because that's a villain, isn't it? Isn't that a Spider-Man?
It was a Spider-Man villain. He was involved.
I know my stuff, sort of. I was really impressed with the movie and just, you know, overall thoughts. I thought it was well paced. It had just the right amount of action. The Robert Downey Jr.'s, you know, wit and humor was on point and really perfect. And I, without question, I can say to me, having rewatched it just recently, it's still, for me personally, it still holds up as one of the best MCU movies.
Mm-hmm.
Period. So those are my initial thoughts. What about yours? Like just
initial, that there are movies that I might enjoy, you know, that might be more fun and exciting to watch. But, I mean, you gotta show, you know, love and respect to, you know, if this movie hadn't worked out, we wouldn't be where we are today.
Oh, certainly, yeah.
You know, I just, like with, you know, at the time I remember thinking, you know, that this is just, you know, like Spider-Man, Spider-Man 2, X-Men, X-Men 2, Batman Begins, Dark Knight wouldn't have come out for a couple more months. Yeah. But, you know, this is just not just one of the best MCU films. I think this is, you could rank that up there with one of the best just comic book films in general.
Yes, you can certainly make that case, yeah.
If, you know, looking back and watching it now, you know, with everything that's happened over the last 10 years with the MCU, it feels different. I'm trying to figure out, like, a way to, like, explain it. But, you know, this was definitely before the time of people critiquing the MCU for being too jokey or not having enough stakes, or, you know, the complaint I hate, which is, you know, they're all the same, or, you know, formula crap. Mm-hmm. Welcome to comic books. They all have formulas. it's a superhero origin story, of course. But, you know, I put this up there with, like, Batman Begins. Nowadays, Man of Steel, Wonder Woman. Mm-hmm. It's a toss, you know. I can't choose, so I'll say Spider-Man and the Amazing Spider-Man. You know, just these really fantastic, not just superhero stories, but also just impressively well-done origin stories, too.
Yeah, and I'm a sucker for the origin story. So anytime you throw that into the mix, more often than not, I'm going to enjoy myself, and I certainly did. One of the things, I mean, I think on the whole, when you look at Tony Stark and his origin story, mm-hmm. I think that this movie was very faithful to the books.
Definitely. Yep.
You know, the main change that you could say that they really made was the setting of Tony's capture, where, you know, back in this in the 60s, it was a different. You were dealing with different threats globally. And so,
yeah, it was, I believe, originally Vietnam.
Yeah.
Where then the movie took inspiration from the retelling of the origin in the book you described, Extremis, which replaced Vietnam with Afghanistan.
Right. And all it is updating for a more modern, mm-hmm. modern scenario. You're trying to reflect to a degree the outside world around you. Uh-huh. You make these things, and that's the nature of the and that's why the change would be.
I have this weird this weird mind where I can remember something being said by someone, but off the top of my head I can't remember who said it. Mm-hmm. I've heard people be like, you know, can blow up Krypton today as long as he lands, you know, in Kansas. You know, you can still tell Superman for Batman, just add a couple extra zeros at the end of the bank accounts and throw the Waynes in an alleyway and shoot them, and you can, you know, still tell the origin of Batman. There's always going to be some kind of military conflict that the U.S. is involved in. As long as that's going on, you can retell the origin of Iron Man.
Yeah, it's true.
I'm sure that they, if they had, you know, I mean, I know that there was the Heroes Reborn thing in the mid-90s, but that's kind of its own thing. But, like, I'm sure if in the 90s Marvel had done a crisis type event and, you know, rebooted everybody from the ground up, you know, the Gulf War or something.
Probably would have been used. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, that's makes sense. Yeah, for sure. So other than that change, I thought for the most part, the origin is really extremely faithful. Mm-hmm. One of the things I loved about it was that in the opening, you sort of, it's a little bit non-linear because you start with, you know, essentially Tony Stark's the attack and then Tony Stark's capture. And then, you know, you see that and then you work your way back to that moment. You get a flashback to like 36 or so hours earlier and you see a little bit of Tony Stark's background, you get a sense of who he is and all that stuff, and then you're taken back to that moment and then the movie picks up from there. I did enjoy that, and I did enjoy the fact that they told some of Tony's story, you know, before the capture, via that when he was getting that award in Las Vegas, via that montage. Right, mm-hmm. He's talking about his father and Obadiah, and then how You know, Tony was this you know, yeah, he did some amazing things in his youth. And then he, what was it, MIT, I think it was, right?
Yeah.
And all that thing, they talk about the father dying. The father and the other dying.
Which we'll get to in a later movie.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a lot of that where, there's a lot of that where some things, you know, tie in. Now, from watching in retrospect, you could see the, little hints and little, you know, markers that would come back and pay off later. But I like the non-linear start of it. I really enjoyed that.
And it doesn't, you know, the pre, you know, explosion and terrorist attack and him being, you know, held captive by the Ten Rings group. None of that feels bloated. You know?
No, it's yeah.
Like I think you mentioned, you know, just a little bit ago that the pacing of this film, there's not a moment wasted. It's not like it goes through everything super. It's like just right.
No,
it's not bloated. It doesn't take forever to get to places, but it also is not like running.
It's a 2-hour and 5-minute, you know, runtime, and for me, I was never at a point where I was like, that was too fast. I feel like something was underserved.
Yeah,
I never felt that. If there was one, I'd take it, but I would never be sitting here clamoring for a director's cut or anything like that. I think the movie is exactly...
I don't think that, you know, this movie would need it.
Yeah. And in terms of Tony's personality pre sort of, you know, well, through, I mean, he has an epiphany, but throughout he still maintains some of his attitude, his smarminess, his, you know, playboy kind of routine. And never did I find myself thinking that this character or this guy was too arrogant or too smarmy that I couldn't, you know, get on board with him. I just like, I kind of like his attitude. Like the guy's, you know.
Maybe, you know. A little bit of, oh, he had it coming, you know, as we're watching like the casino and the awards thing and on the plane and
yeah,
you know, but you do, at least for me, I genuinely felt that, you know, his experience with the Ten Rings and in the cave and building the proto suit, you know, that really had a huge fundamental effect.
Yeah, and I'm glad you. But before I get to that, because I'm glad you brought that up, there was a point where he's like, okay, you know, like you could see something like this coming because of the way he behaves. But never did I think he was like an unlikable character, even with his attitude and all that. Yeah. I think what's fascinating is that, you know, a lot of people talk about, you know, there's a point throughout the journey of the MCU where Tony starts to change as a person. And, you know, some point to Civil War, you know, when he first befriends Peter and stuff like that. But I think it happens right in this movie. And that is, I right when, you know, right when he has that experience in the cave, and Yinsen, you know, gives him a second chance at life and sacrifices himself. I think that's the moment where Tony Stark experiences his first real change. I mean, more things evolve his personality as the movies go on, but that was really the start of the change. I think right from the get-go.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You see it because he's kind of, you know, he interacts with Happy, you know, before he interacts with Happy and Obadiah, you know, before all the crap goes down, and he's really closest with really those two, you know, before the cave incident. But then in the, but with everybody else, he's kind of closed off or standoffish kind of bit, a little bit. But I think you really see that start to change the moment where he and Yinsen are in the throes of, you know, building his Mark I armor, where he starts asking for personal information of Yinsen, like, what's your name? What's your name? Do you have a family? That's where you see Tony really letting his guard down and letting the facade down and mm-hmm. you know, opening up and letting somebody else in, letting some. I think Tony saying, you know, asking for those details is Tony's way of letting somebody in.
Mm-hmm. It's all, you know, I kind of, I'm going to say this with the hindsight of knowing Tony's entire MCU journey. Now in hindsight, but he really does kind of come across as something I can relate to, like using humor
as, it's a deflecting
mechanism. Yeah. As a coping mechanism, yes.
Agreed, 100% with that. So I really like that, you know, that burgeoning friendship in the cave.
Mm-hmm.
And then that sequence in the cave with the Mark I armor is exceptional. And I'm not going to belittle the MCU for using CGI, because, again, these are comic book movies. And if there are modern movies that are forced to CGI Superman's cape on him because of, I call that more laziness than anything else. But if we're going that far, then who am I to begrudge the MCU for using more CGI in later films? However, there's something special about that cave sequence because, you know, I've watched the film a few times, and you know that they actually build a portion of that armor.
Mm-hmm.
And that is impressive.
Yeah, there's a lot, and that's something that I'm with you. I do not begrudge the use of CGI. People that, you know, who claim to be comic book fans and comic book movie fans who complain about, oh, too much CGI or the third act, it's, I think you're in the wrong fandom. If that's what you complain about the most. But, you know, the reverse of that, you know, the other end of the sword for that for me is I really love that in this movie there's a lot of practical effects.
Exactly.
Maybe with Ironmonger at the end, that's a mostly CG character. But a good chunk of Tony wearing the suit, Robert Downey does have, you know, maybe from like the waist up, he is wearing a suit.
Yeah,
he actually is wearing something there. And I don't begrudge studios for going CG. I get it. But I do kind of.
But
like
it just
that.
Changes the feel when you know it's tangible because you can see it on, you can notice it on film. Now, don't get me wrong, the CGI that they use now for the most part is great.
Mm-hmm. But
you can just tell when something is being done practically.
Yeah, there is something in us that just we relate to and enjoy seeing that there's something.
The eye and the mind can tell, even though CGI has gotten really good. But the eye and the mind can notice it.
And I'm sure that it helps out, you know, with the actors on set to actually have something physically there. There was an interview with Werner Herzog for the Mandalorian, where they were entertaining the idea of having Baby Yoda be a CG character instead of the animatronic puppet that they used. And he actually, you know, fought to have it still be, you know, actual physical thing there because it gave him something to interact with.
But yeah, that scene just looked great from everything from you know, the breakout of the cave where, you know, they're going to the door where Tony and Yinsen are being held, And you know, the Afghani soldiers, you know, knocking, or the terror, whatever he is, knocking on the door to get out. And then you see from the other perspective, and I don't know what Tony's doing to him, but it looks, you imagine he's crushing him with that armor. And the way the door, you know, the way the door bends and dents inward, it's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. And then, like, you even see, even though Tony's having his first big hero moment, they even go to great pains to show you that this isn't, you know, he builds this and it's perfect. Like, he does get the arm gets stuck in the cave wall, and he has to, you know, fight to break it out, to break out. Then when it's in flight later on, you know, it can't sustain the flight, so it breaks apart. So there are issues with his armor. It's not like he right away they're telling you that, you know, Tony is not an infallible character, and not everything he does is you know, perfection, right?
And probably, you know, subconsciously, or, you know, I'm not sure, but planting the seeds of that Tony is a perfectionist, and that's why he never just lets the suit kind of be the suit for a long period of time. He's always tinkering with it. He's always trying to make the next suit better. That perfect Iron Man suit, and he's always going to have to work on it.
And you even see it in this first film where every time he upgrades the suit, he fixes a previous problem that he had on it. And that would continue throughout the MCU, but you could see it as early on in this film. And you could, you know what, when he uses the flame, the flamethrower bit on his armor when he breaks out of the cave before he flies off, you know, at that moment, I don't know about you, but I had fist in the air screaming, yeah, those guys deserve it. Because just for the sheer fact of, you're going along the ride with Tony. So when he realizes that his weapons are being used to bring about mass death and being turned on the soldiers that they're being made to protect, he realizes that there's a problem, and that's when he starts questioning it. So you are basically we're with Tony in that moment, taking back ownership not only of his technology, but of his name, because his name is on the building, his name is on the weaponry, and you as an audience member, because you've built up now, you know, a good half an hour, 40 minutes with this character, before any, you know, as this is all happening, you are in a way put in his shoes. And I dig that. I also dig the irony of the fact that the weapon that almost killed him, you know, the shrapnel is still there, and he's had to use pieces of weaponry that almost killed him to keep him alive. That was pretty. I love that bit of irony, and and I, you know, for the short time that we got Yinsen, I was really sad that he didn't make it out. I mean, I knew he had to fulfill the Thomas Wayne and Uncle Ben and kind of role, but in the short time we got, you really sort of, you know, in that little story he tells about his family, you right then and there, you feel for that character, and you want the best for that character. Ultimately, it doesn't happen, but again, I think the message that he gives Tony is something that I'll say Tony carries with him throughout the rest of this time in the MCU, which is, you've got a second chance at life, don't waste it.
Yeah.
And he doesn't. So I really like in that opening bit of the film, you know, that opening, you know, first third, that we're getting all these little, you know, signs on the roadmap that would eventually culminate in Endgame, and it starts right with this movie. Like, nothing is done by accident or in a reactionary way. It was like the meticulous planning that you notice on the on a rewatch like this, it makes it all the more impressive.
Yeah, they obviously did not have Avengers Endgame in mind back in 2008. No. Yeah. But you know, the seeds for, you know, the overarching 10, 11 year arc for the character of Tony Stark, it's not just, you know, like a throwaway joke or something. There is serious, you know, the seeding of character moments that'll, you know, inevitably pay off.
Right. And so in the second act of the film kind of thing, we get what we see is we've now moved out of the Middle East, and we're now in you know, I don't want to say modern day because it's not the right word, but we're in you know, we're in Tony's natural habitat, and so now we can see him we can see him interact with the likes of Obadiah Stane, Rhodey, and Pepper. And I think, first of all, when Tony Stark, one and the same, see how good he was? when Tony Stark makes that declaration about, you know, at Stark Industries, about essentially, that's it, I'm done with the weapons. We're not doing this. We're going to make sure, or when we do, we're going to make sure it's being done in the right way, and that our soldiers are safe and our people are safe. I really think that even though, you know, his revelation happens in that first third, I think that decision is more than understandable, obviously, but also very much earned.
Because he's known his whole life of, yeah, his company and the, you know, Stark Industries has been pushing the boundaries of technology, but let's face it, you know, most of their profits have been from, you know, the U.S. government for,
yeah,
you know, instruments of war.
So but do you agree that change of heart was warranted? And
circling back to when we were talking about, you know, nothing being bloated and everything just kind of feeling like it perfectly, or as perfectly as possible, paced. It feels natural. It feels earned. You know, nothing about the change of heart that Tony experiences, none of that ever felt forced to me.
Yeah. An interesting little note. Did you know that the Burger King cheeseburger bit was actually something out of Robert Downey Jr.'s true life situation?
No, I did not know that. I just kind of assumed, you know, again, in hindsight, knowing who, you know, Robert Downey is nowadays, that there's probably a lot of improvisation. But go on. I know I didn't know that.
Basically, you know, when he was down on his luck and in the throes of the drug habit and all that, he had found an old greasy cheeseburger. And having to resort to eating that because he was so down and out of it made him, you know, basically shook him out and was one of the catalysts for helping him turn his life around. And so they put that in the
movie. To have that, you know, be mirrored when, you know, Tony at the lowest in his, I did not know that. Okay.
Yeah, so that was kind of fascinating when I found out as well, because I didn't know that while I was watching it. I just thought he had a thing for cheeseburgers. which is understandable because they're damn good.
Okay, because before then, I just assumed, okay, Robert Downey thinks that Tony would want a cheese pie, which I get it. I probably would too.
Well, I got to say, I will be honest. When I saw him eating the cheeseburger, I'm like, hey, I want one now. I'm hungry.
I'm hungry too. that's interesting. I like that, you know, Downey uses his own, a tragic moment in his life, you know, and basically kind of portrays a fictional version of that for this character. Okay, I like that.
And did you notice, is it just me, or was, did Happy Hogan have the most minimal screen time in this, in this particular movie, out of all the movies he's been in? Like, for the most part, he was just the driver in this, in this, in this movie.
I never would have expected that the character of Happy Hogan would
have
outlive Tony Stark.
Oh, neither would have I. Yeah, yeah.
We have Happy Hogan, you know, in Spider-Man Far From, the movie after Tony died.
And I hope he sticks around, because I do like him in that role.
I do too, and I like it that, you know, because it is Favreau, it is the guy who directed this, who is, you know, who worked with Feige to jump start the Marvel Cinematic Universe, you know, fought to get Robert Downey to become the face of it, that, you know, and I'm sure I probably mentioned this in our Far From Home review last year, that I love that he's still sticking around, you know, helping out Marvel in, you know, this capacity.
Agreed. So let's move towards kind of Tony's sort of pre the reveal that Obadiah was behind. Spoilers for a 12-year-old movie. But Obadiah Stane is behind the kidnapping of Tony Stark and is the ultimate villain of the piece. In case you've been living in a cave in Afghanistan, you didn't know that all these years later, there you go. But pre that sort of reveal, did you feel a contentiousness between Tony and Obadiah from the start?
No,
I didn't buy that that mentor mentee father son kind of relationship.
In the open package.
I didn't buy that.
I've never taken it that way. I've always taken it as not even really a mentor figure at all. Just like, you know, your kind of, you know, not really, you know, blood related uncle, but, you know, you were my, you know, close friend of my father, and, you know, sure, why not? I'll let you do all the work.
What I mean is, could you, maybe I didn't word it right, but could you sense a sort of jealousy from Obadiah's point of view?
From Obadiah, yes, you know.
Okay, that's what I mean, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Because I never bought that father-son bullshit, yeah, from the package there.
No, never, but... You know, while Obadiah may be the one who, at the start of this movie, is actually, you know, kind of the head of everything, you know, running Stark Industries, Tony's just the guy, you know, the face of the company who helps out with design work. And
okay, so but you did catch it. You did catch on. Okay.
Yes.
So now we move on to, because I want to come back to the, you know, the reveal and then all that stuff with Coulson and all that. But the relationship between Tony Stark and Pepper Potts, I think, is one of the better how can I word this? Love interest kind of relationships in superhero films, because it's not an automatic from her point of view where she's in puppy dog mode, right? And she's automatically in love with this guy. She's not portrayed as a damsel in distress at all. She's very competent. She's very, I mean, she does most of Tony's hard work for him. Like, the, I mean, the day-to-day keeping, basically she keeps him in a position where he can function as a businessman. And without her, God knows what would happen to that company. But
no wonder Tony will eventually put her in charge of it.
Yeah, 12%. I just liked how she was from the start, this competent, you know, independent person. Mm-hmm. And it was never, she was never his arm candy or, like I said, a damsel in distress. Mm-hmm. Anything of that nature. And, you know, he was the one sort of at the start kind of hinting and pushing at something more than just, you know, the business relationship and possibly friends to a degree. So it's kind of, you can see where the genres, you know, come. To where it used to be literally, you know, for example, Vicky Vale is there to scream for the most part and be saved by, and be saved by Batman.
Yeah.
Same with Chase Meridian, you know, Aquaman's mom. Same with, forget about whatever her name is, Elle McPherson. She was just, I feel bad for her that she had been there.
I'm sure she's a lovely lady. There are times I forget that she's even in the movie.
Yeah, she was just there because they needed a girl. I love interest. You know, you already know my feelings on Kristen Dunst, another Vicky Vale to corner.
Even though it's, you know, over the course of two films played by two different actresses, but
Rachel Dawes,
Rachel Dawes, I think that's a good example.
Yeah. So, you know, it's really evolved and I think on the Marvel side, definitely Pepper Potts is a forebearer of that. I would even say Gwen Stacy to a degree.
In the Amazing movie. Yep.
Yeah, in the Amazing movies. Even from the Marvel side, I would put Peggy Carter in there as a good one. I think another good example on the DC side would probably be Lois Lane as portrayed by the likes of Terry Hatcher and Erica Durance, specifically, and even, you know, now in later iterations, Bitsy Tolik. So there, like, you see how it's evolved, because, you know, going back, if you go back to, like, I don't remember much of Betty Brant or Betty Ross either of the Hulk movies. I haven't rewatched The Incredible Hulk in a while, so I'll be able to tell you, but especially in the Eric Bana,
I would never say that either of them were portrayed as damsel in distress, but it's also not like, because a lot of the examples that you and I have brought up are, you know, they help out and assist in like fights and battles to the extent that they can. Betty Ross in either Hulk or Incredible Hulk don't really do that, but they're also like never they're portrayed as, you know, strong and smart and all that, but never assisting the Hulk, you know, and never being, like we've described, the damsel in distress. So yeah, they're kind of in the middle.
Yeah. So I really liked Pepper in this, and I think the evolution, like them, here's another way of what I'm trying to say. them going from the relationship at the start of the film to the relationship at the end of the film and then in subsequent movies felt like a natural progression, even from the beginning of the film to the end. It was it never felt forced. Yeah.
And it doesn't feel forced. This is one of those examples where the relationship, you know, again, over the course of the entire MCU, but also here in just this movie, there's a little bit of flirting, but there's never any outright, there's no kiss, there's no outright romantic moment. You know, it's a build up to it, and they didn't force it. They didn't feel like they had to. And you know, I'm not one to ever say that superhero, you know, the trope of the romance and on a superhero film, you know, it doesn't bother me. If it's there, fine. But just, you know, don't just have it there just to have it there. Right. You know, don't force it. If you're going to do something with it, you know, make it mean something to either characters.
And, you know, and they definitely do with these two and this franchise. Uh-huh. But, you know, with these two characters, Ryan, you know what you could actually really say, and it would actually be true.
Oh, God. what are you getting at?
Tony and Pepper forever, from the first kiss to the last. You can actually say that with this couple. And thank you to this movie and this franchise for allowing me to actually say that and on some level mean it, while also still having Ryan laugh in stitches,
because I knew it was going to be from the first something to the last. I just didn't know what the hell else.
So Tom King, your dialogue actually works every once in a while. Good job. Oh, my God. See, I can be nice to Tom King in a condescending way. No, actually his there was a DC book he wrote that was really... His Superman stuff is really good. That's what I did there. That was my Tom King.
I still need to read that. When that's actually released, you know, hardcover book, I'll get that. I know that you've praised his Mr. Miracle. You just didn't like his Batman stuff. That's fine.
That's right, yeah.
You like the guy's other work, so, you know, his take on Batman, that's fine.
Before we get into the really big action, let's talk about Rhodey in this film, played by Terrence. I wanted more money, Howard.
Exactly. So no, there will be no next time, baby.
Yeah, you screwed yourself out of that next time, sir.
I know you teased that so well, and then you kind of screwed yourself.
Yeah, it's like I'm gonna get to. He's like, cool, I'm going to get to wear this. But then I'm going to ask for my money, so I'm just going to kick myself in the nuts with a pair of cleats. And that's basically what he did. But, you know, I'm not going to get into Don Cheadle's performance, but, going back to this and then having Don Cheadle continue, I'm not going to mince words. I like Don Cheadle better.
I do too.
There's something about rewatching this, and I don't know what it is. I can't tell you what it is. But if I had to pick one thing that didn't work for me in this movie, it is Terrence Howard as Rhodey. I just never really felt like a friendship between these two. Like, it never... really, like, I it never felt honest to me. It felt like two people literally acting, which is what they were doing, but it should never, you never want it to feel like, you never want it to come off as acting. And I think that's what it did here. And the second thing, and again, there's no fault of his own, this is my own hang up. There's something about Terrence Howard's voice that I can't take him seriously. I don't know what it is. So I'm kind of glad that he got recast, because for me, he was the weakest link.
I don't think Howard is necessarily bad. with the material that he has in this movie, it's just, there's not much, despite having a, you know, significant amount of screen time, you know, it just doesn't feel like there's a lot, there's not a lot of meat on the bone, despite the bone being long.
That's a good point.
Where, you know, we've only had one movie with him, and what, 5, 6, 7, 8 appearances or something.
Yeah.
With Cheadle. I feel like Cheadle gets the character better. You know, obviously I'm kind of saying that with the bias of, well, we had a hell of a lot more exposure with him as Rhodey.
But also, I think part of it is because he feels more as a military man.
He feels more military man.
There's a little more authoritarian.
I'm sorry, I can't really imagine Howard in the War Machine armor.
Like, would you take orders from Terrence Howard?
Come on. I'm sorry. And also, I think one of the bigger things with it that you kind of teased around was, I think the chemistry between Downey and Cheadle is so much on point, and it provides, you know, throughout, you know, the MCU, just in general, it provides great comedic moments and just, you know, great character moments between the two of them. It's just there while it feels not great, not bad, just kind of whatever between Downey and Howard.
So before we get to like the you know, Obadiah's turn in the third act stuff, I want to point out, because we kind of went over it a little bit, but the sort of in between moments with Tony again tinkering with his armor, you know, and he's working on the silver, the sleeker silver version, which I think was Mark II, if my numbering is correct. That whole bit when he's trying to sustain the flight capability with the robot that douses him all the time.
Oh God, I forgot what the robot's name is, but I love it.
Me too. But it was hilarious. And man, every time he fell on or scratched one of those cars, I felt so bad for those poor cars. And I'm not that much of a car guy, but those look like some pretty nice cars. And I was just like, damn, that's just a shame. But again, I like where he gets the idea to put the red in the suit. So it's a combination of he's hearing the news report of the firefighters gala. So firefighters and, you know, real life heroes. So he's sort of adopting the colors of you know, he wants to be. And Iron Man is very much like, you could compare him to a firefighter in a way. You know what I mean? Like a situation arises, and he goes out and in this film anyway, and deals with it. So it's very much like that in a way. So I like that. In, at least in the movie terms, yes, part of it is the color of the car, but he also gets the idea sparked to add the red because of, you know, wanting to sort of emulate, you know, firefighters who are in reality could be considered real life heroes, right? So I dug that. Where does this, because I love this cameo, I think it's hilarious. And anytime Stan Lee gets to hang around beautiful girls, I know he was happy. So, and God bless him. I hope I'm like him when I'm old. If I get, hopefully I get there. But you know, what did you think of his cameo?
It was absolutely cute that, you know, he gets to be Hugh Hefner for a moment, because he sure as hell was feeling that way, you know, as the MCU grew more and more popular. So
I wish I could ask him. But I have a feeling Deadpool is his favorite cameo still. Something tells me that was his favorite cameo.
One of I don't know if I would commit to it being my top favorite, but in my top, like.
No, I think it was his, though. It was Stan Lee's.
Yeah.
For obvious reasons.
I still like the first Amazing Spider-Man.
Yeah, that was a great cameo.
That's my personal favorite.
I know, I was howling in the theater with laughter when that. Mm-hmm. But okay, so we're into the. Let's talk about the third act here, because now we've got a lot of things happening. You know, it's mm-hmm. we get the big reveal of you know, Obadiah being the culprit behind Tony's abduction by the Ten Rings.
Which I knew like nothing about Iron Man, but even I was like, well, duh. Yeah.
And, you know, I gotta say, I miss the days when the Ten Rings used to be a formidable and scary threat. Like they actually.
I know you'll probably have stuff to say once we get to Iron Man 3, but I'm confident enough that Shang-Chi will redeem all of this.
Listen, if they don't, nobody will. But I was legitimately curious and kind of, in terms of the stakes of the story, intimidated by that group. And I'm like, okay, they're setting up for them to come back. And I knew of the Mandarin. So I'm like, oh, he's got to be a villain in one of these Iron Man movies. Boy, was I stupid.
he'll be a villain.
We had Dragon Man instead. Gandhi pretending to be the Mandarin, but I was looking forward to the payoff of that. Still waiting, but hopefully, like you said, Shang-Chi,
yeah.
So come on, played by a Canadian actor. Let's go do me a solid and correct this. I mean, Shang-Chi is Canadian. The other guy is a Canadian-born actor. I don't know about the Mandarin guy, but. So because you're Canadian, you better do right by what I want. I'm going to quote Drax himself in his WWE days. Give me what I want. And all I want is the proper Mandarin, damn it. But no, that was great. And you really get a sense of the, how can I say this politely? Well, there's no real way to say it without kind of somewhat cursing. You really get a sense of the assholian levels of Obadiah Stane when, and I think I just made up a word, when he temporarily paralyzes the I can't even call him the head of the Ten Rings because he's not, but the the main representative of the Ten Rings, the bald guy, let's call him Arab Lex Luthor. When he paralyzes that guy, and then as he's leaving the tent, he's like, okay, well, you know, take the prototype, take the suit, and then get rid of everything else. And then all those people get shot and killed on the spot. Now, granted, those are some pretty bad people. There were no good people on either side of that, quoting from some orange dude. So, you know, you don't long for the fact that they're no longer around, but it's still a dick move on his part, for sure. And then, you know, turning on Tony and like Obadiah is the kind of guy that you just want to see him get what's coming to him. At least from what I was watching, that's.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Now, there is a complaint, but in some circles, that they found Jeff Bridges a little bit over the top, and
why? Because he built this in a cave with a box of scraps.
Well, that's what some people say. So let me ask you, did you find once he got to Ironmonger levels. Did you find him to be over the top at all?
God, there's two ways I want to answer that question. pathway number one, it's a comic book movie. People are allowed to go a little over the top when they finally embrace their supervillain, destiny in a movie. That's fine. It's what I pay, $8-$9 to go see. More seriously, I don't know. Okay. I said that with a question mark. I could see why people may think that, mm-hmm. but the way I interpret it from a character perspective is that, Obadiah had been faking, compassion and giving a damn for Stark and everyone else, for Tony and everyone else at Stark Industries.
Yeah.
And after finally getting, whatever the heck his name was at the Ten Rings, like you said, Al Qaeda, Lex Luthor, whatever.
Yeah. Well, I said Arab, but yeah.
Arab Lex Luthor.
Al Qaeda would have been better.
He just doesn't give a frack.
Yeah.
And because he sees that, he thinks, okay, I got them out of the way, so I don't need to worry about them possibly exposing me. He thinks that when he takes the new and improved arc reactor out of Tony's chest, he thinks, well, now I've killed Tony, so I don't have to worry about him flying around in the suit. Mm-hmm. And why he thinks he's, achieved what he wants. And what he wanted was to be, it's not a world domination plot, but it's I want to get rich by making these, armored suits for the good guys, for the bad guys. I don't care. Just pay, as long as I get paid.
Mm.
Which I don't know with how often that's used nowadays. And hell, it's used in Iron Man 3 as the villain's motivation and, ultimate plot. I don't know if that's going to become as trite in the future as world domination. Oh, you want to rule the world? Whatever. Oh, you want to make money from both sides of a military conflict? Whatever.
Yeah. No, I agree with you.
But back, in 2008, when this came out, it was still rather a new and fresh, villain motive. So I'm okay with it here.
Yeah, same. In terms of the final battle, and then we'll do a little special quick section on Coulson in a second, and the debut of Coulson. But in terms of the third act battles, I really like the one on the street where they're in the middle of traffic. Because, and I know we're veering off into a different franchise, but when Obadiah throws the car at Tony, and he catches it.
You got an Action Comics number one vibe.
100%.
Never thought about it until you just said it, but now I'm not gonna. Now I'm gonna be on it.
I thought that was really cool. I'm like, all right, I see what you did there. And maybe they didn't do it on purpose, but in my head, I'm gonna assume they did, and I'm gonna tip my hat that I'm not wearing to them.
Wait, let me go find a hat so I can
see. Yeah, I'm gonna have to get up and take my headphones. That's a lot of work. I'm not doing that. So I like that. And I think Ironmonger battling Tony Stark or Tony Stark hanging on to him, or they are battling in in the air, in midair. Obviously, that had to be predominantly CGI, if not all CGI.
Oh, of course, yeah.
But it didn't look it. Like, you get lost in it in the movie. And I really like that. And again, I like that we're seeing Tony's ingenuity here when he purposely kind of lures him up there, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that the suit would start freezing, the armor would start freezing. And he knew he could take advantage of that. I love how, throughout the course of this movie, yes, Tony has the wonderful toys, the armor, and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But that all hinges on him using his brain.
Yep.
So when Captain America and the Avengers say, if you take away the armor and the money, what are you? And well, he's a pretty damn
genius.
Smart.
Genius, right. Billionaire, yeah. Playboy, philanthropist.
So there you go. But the genius, is paramount. And I think that aids him in his heroics as much as the physicality of the suits do. But what was your favorite? Like, if you had to pick a favorite action moment, what would you?
From the final fight, it would probably be my favorite part of it. Would be the rooftop part. You know, when I just like love the visual of Iron Man running, leaping, doing the punch. Ironmonger doing the wanting to try and break you in half kind of hug, that super tight hug.
It was really basically like a wrestling match, because you know, Iron Man did Roman Reigns Superman punch, or maybe got from there, and you know, Ironmonger was like Andre the Giant between doing bear hugs and lifting Tony over his head and doing like a modified backbreaker. All that was missing was Vince McMahon on commentary halfway through in the third act there. So that's a good call. And as we were talking before about Pepper having a really big role, she's instrumental in the finality of the movie, because
by having to activate the big, you know, arc reactor at the plant in order to electrocute Obadiah.
Mm. Yeah. Now, so I really like that. So, you know, they kept her consistent throughout the film, and they didn't forget about her in the third act, which can sometimes happen if she's not being saved. But we got to talk a little bit about the first appearance of Agent Phil Coulson, played by Clark Gregg. What did you think of him and the references to Shield?
I have to admit that, like, the first time, interesting story here, I really didn't put much, because I wasn't a comic fan at this point. I was more of the casual from the movies and occasional TV shows and cartoons. So I wasn't really aware of what Shield was. I just thought, oh, cool, that's like, I probably just thought it was going to be, oh, that's some, correctly thinking, oh, it's going to be some government agency involved with superheroes and whatnot. But when I first saw this movie, I never thought to stick to the end. And I'm not trying to jump to the end. I'm just kind of, so I didn't know that they were going to be teasing anything. So it's credit start rolling. Oh, I'm going to get going.
Yeah.
So I just thought it was just, a fun character. You know, he had some good one-liners. You know, I probably thought, hey, I hope we see more of Coulson. This guy seems like he could, just be in general fun addition to the lore and the mythos. Never expected him to become at least important with the Shield aspect, though.
I was like you. I really didn't know, like, what Shield was.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, because we went opening night, and I remember when they heard, I think it was Coulson that said the strategic blah, 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 the whole thing. people are like, ooh, like in the audience. And I'm like, what the hell? Why are people oohing and aahing for? What the hell does that mean? And then they did it again when he abbreviated it to Sheila. I'm like, what the hell? Okay, something's going on with this thing. So, I don't, people are reacting to this.
We're seriously like missing something.
Yeah, like people are reacting to this like it's a thing. And I don't know what this thing is, but I guess we'll find out. But I always laughed when I saw him on screen because he seemed to show up at the most inconvenient, inopportune time. And like he was so blunt and matter of fact that that always just made me laugh. So like you, back at that point, I did want to see more of him. And I hoped he returned, which of course he would. For a few more films.
And then die and then become the lead character on the TV show.
Yeah, so that's just as things happen in comic book related material. But, you know, then we get, and I knew that we had to stay because a friend of mine said, I've read that there's something after the credits. And I'm like, well, at first when, because I was getting up to leave like you, and he's like, no, we got to stay. And I'm like, what do you mean we got to stay? I got to take a leak. What the hell's going on here?
And there's nothing. Why would they put something at the end of the movie? What's the point of it?
How much water? I drank a whole bottle of water here with the, you know, with this popcorn. Why I got to stay here for? So we stayed, and then we saw the part with Samuel Jackson. And I don't know if I knew who the hell Nick Fury was at the time, because I wasn't reading much Marvel. The Marvel that I knew about was, you know, the 90s Spider-Man cartoon, the 90s X-Men cartoon. And if they had mentioned Nick Fury at all before, I had not remembered it. And I was blissfully ignorant to the failed pilot that started David Hasselhoff, so I didn't know about that either.
I heard about it from, I saw it the first time, walked out as soon as the credits started rolling. I went back to school because this was on the Friday. I went back to, because I was in high school at this time.
Oh, wow. We're going way back, eh?
I think 2008, May of 2008 would be my junior year.
Okay.
I go back Monday and, you know, I didn't have that many friends. Secondly, I didn't have that many friends.
Oh, you do now, so that's what
I didn't have that many friends who had seen the movie. Oh. And I'm hearing them talking about, post-credit thing. And I'm like, wait, there's something at the end. What's at the end? I might have to go back and see this movie.
And that began your multiple viewing routine.
And then it began. and I told my dad about it. He had no idea either, so we probably, you know, the second weekend probably went back and saw it. Had to have him explain who Nick Fury was. And see, my dad was more old school traditional, Marvel and whatnot. So he said that he was more familiar with, I don't know if he'd ever seen it, but like the David Hasselhoff, like that kind of a Nick Fury, the more traditional classic. But
So my friend really had to tell me about, like you, who the hell Nick Fury was. And when they said the Avengers, I'm like, what are they talking about? And so, you know, I got the explainer, and then I went, because, you know, I don't even remember how old was 12, what did I say, 12 years ago? I was 24. Oh, the good old days. I sound like a 70-year-old man now. I sound like Captain America at the end of Endgame. So I went on the following Wednesday. I went to the comic store, as you do on Wednesdays, or you used to. And hopefully,
For the time being, or at least for Tuesdays, for now, maybe.
And
we'll see how things play.
We'll see how it plays out. So I went back and I said, listen, I just watched this Iron Man movie. I talked because my comic guy, he knew I was a DC guy, so he does both. So he asked me, I said, oh, it was really good. I really like this Iron Man character. Yeah, that's good. And I said, but the guy at the end, Nick Fury, Samuel Jackson was talking about some, he said the Avengers. I said, what the hell is that? And so, my comic guy started giving me more of an explainer. I said, you got any books? Which is usually my response. And I can hear my wallet screaming from inside my pants. And he said, actually, since you just saw the movie, why don't you read this? And he handed me Volume 1 of The Ultimates.
Ooh.
And lo and behold, Nick Fury looks like Samuel Jackson. And they even mentioned Robert Downey Jr. playing Tony Stark in the book. So I had thought this was all, you know, pre-planned. Like, oh, this is fantastic. You know, and then again, they also mentioned Samuel Jackson in the book. And so I was fascinated. So for me, Nick Fury wasn't, my first exposure to Nick Fury was the Ultimate version. So he was never a white guy before. And then I started searching Nick Fury just to find background information. And that's when I discovered, oh, there's this thing. And the Ultimate Universe is different. And there was this thing with David Hasselhoff, which I was fascinated by.
I love that word, fascinated.
Because, no, for me, David Hasselhoff was Knight Rider and the guy that hung around with all those pretty girls on Baywatch. And that was the extent of it. So I was very familiar with Hasselhoff, just not that. What most of the world did when Thanos was mentioned at the end of the first Avengers, I did when Nick Fury came on screen. Because none of the general audience knew who Thanos was, and I had no clue. I mean, at that point I knew because I had been reading for a few years. But at the point of Iron Man, I had no clue who Nick Fury was or what the Avengers were. So I was certainly... I'm glad to say, back then, I was surprised by and shocked by the existence of a post-credit scene. Now you're told to expect it, so it's a little different. But back then, it really had an effect on me. So yeah,
and to think that because of that, now we all have to, we're all so trained to sit and wait during.
You know, I just wish they'd stick to one, because now they're throwing in four or five, and I'm like, all right, you're testing the limits of my bladder here.
Uh-huh.
You know, and it's really getting, and you know, the movies are getting longer, so it's not
at tops, the midway point, and at the end, I'm okay with that. Yeah. But yeah, like, yeah.
But Guardians of the Galaxy had about 15, and I'm like, Jesus, come on, I gotta pee.
You know? At least they were short-ish.
Yeah, that's true. And then we got to my most sort of kind of disappointing one of all, post credits, which unfortunately was Birds of Prey, because it's basically Harley Quinn just saying, so you want to know a secret about Batman? And then I'm like, that's really?
I thought you were going to say Spider-Man Homecoming, when it's just Captain America talking about, you know, patience. And
that was funny.
Exactly. Because like, oh, I waited all this time for nothing. Okay, you got me.
I laughed at that. It was one Marvel one that did that. I can't remember which one it was. That kind of bugged me, but I can't remember which one that was. But
you don't remember what movie?
It might have been the Howard the Duck one. Because Guardians 2 had 14 of them. But Guardians 1 had the Howard the Duck thing, right? At the end.
At the very end.
Yeah, okay. That was the one I'm like, really? I waited here all this time for Howard the Duck?
But it's Howard the Duck.
Exactly, that's my point.
Getting his his, you know, screw it. I will say cinematic debut.
His revival? Revival? Is that what you're...
Cinematic revival, getting his cinematic reboot before the cinematic debuts of Captain Marvel, of Ant-Man, of Black Panther. Howard the Duck, we got him.
Unbelievable. you know, now that you're mentioning that he came before all that, it's pissing me off all over again. We're just going to leave that there and get to it when we get to it on the actual Guardians show, where I'll rant about it some more. I guess we've covered everything. So with that said, give me final thoughts and a rating.
It's
always like, the hardest part of the show for you.
I know. Like I said at the top of all this, you know, this to me isn't just a gold standard for MCU movies. I think this is a gold standard for comic book films in general. You know, Marvel, DC, Image, Valiant, whoever, you know, they can learn a lot from the blueprint that was set up here with Iron Man, where, you know, the pacing is just right, that the writing is, you know, there's no bloating, you know, everything fits together like a perfect, neat little puzzle. It was just such a joy to watch, and I don't watch it nearly as often as I probably should compared to all the other, because again, released, there are 23 movies, there's a lot, but I definitely need to start putting this into rotation a little bit more often, because it's only now, what, like you said, 12 years old, but it feels like it's going to be a classic, and one that I hope is fondly remembered and put, you know, up there with like X2 and Spider-Man 2 and Superman the movie and Batman 89. I think you could throw, you know, the first Iron Man up there as like truly the best superhero films. If we're gonna do it as a letter grade, I gotta give it an A. I gotta give it just, you know, it just an outright A. It's absolutely wonderful, and you know, so much to love about this movie, and this is the beginning. Is the beginning of, you know, one of the most successful media franchises of all time. Not the first shared cinematic universe. You know, Universal Monsters and Godzilla.
And don't forget Batman 66 with the Green Hornet. Come on. Let's call it like it is.
But, you know, there should be no poo-pooing what the MCU has done. And if this movie hadn't been the success that it was, you know, maybe they would have, I think that Marvel would have maybe tried again, but it wouldn't have been probably maybe until like around this time that they would have, you know, attempted something like this again.
Yeah, probably. If the whole thing had collapsed, I think we would have seen a bunch more Spider-Man movies from Sony. Which is not a bad thing. I'm not saying that in a bad way.
It's a movie from Fox, and
maybe another couple of attempts at Fantastic Four. Please, can we just get it? Can we get one absolutely right from start to finish? Is that too much to ask?
I think the first.
I like the first two, but most of the first two. But there are parts I have problems with. I just want one movie. I want one Fantastic Four movie like Iron Man, where that I can love it from moment one to moment, you know, however long 2 hours and 5 minutes is, or however long this next Fantastic Four movie ends up being.
And I'm sure we'll get that whenever, you know, Feige and Marvel Studios, you know, finally get into a fan.
For my money, though, I think one of Marvel's most riskiest films ended up turning into a film that was a groundbreaking success that changed the nature of superhero cinema. Like Ryan said, you absolutely have a ton of fun when you're watching this. The visual effects hold up 12 years later.
Yep. Very much so. Yeah.
Yeah. And by the way, a special shout out to that one where in that scene in Golmira where he turns back and shoots with the, you know, And then he's walking away and exposed. That was a great looking shot.
To me, it's my favorite slow mo walking away from
a explosion. Yeah, yeah, it's a great slow mo shot. Yeah, for sure. And so the effects still hold up, and like Ryan was saying, I think this can be held up with the likes of Superman the movie, Batman Begins, the Dark Knight, X2, Spider-Man 2, as the great, you know, as one of the greats of the genre. And I can also say that Iron Man put Robert Downey Jr. in the same position as I think the likes of Christopher Reeve, Hugh Jackman, I'm trying to think of a Batman equivalent, but I don't know if we've had the perfect Batman yet. We've had perfect elements in each portrayal, but yeah. But especially, those two come to mind, Chris Reeve and Hugh Jackman, as just being like the actor has morphed into that character 100%, and is truly believable as that character. And I don't know if Marvel's ever going to hit the reset button and try Iron Man ever again by recasting. You know, maybe that's something 20, 30 years down the road. I don't know. But if it ever comes to a time where that happens, God help the poor soul that has to follow up Robert Downey Jr. as Iron Man. Because that ain't going to be an easy task. Feel free to ask Brandon Routh, Tom Welling, Henry Cavill, and everybody else that will play Superman henceforth. So, yeah, it's going to be he just defined the character and became an extent, like they became an extension of each other. And yeah, I think what I can see, you know what's appropriate to say about this movie? I love it 3000. How about that?
Oh, perfect way to end this. I love it 3000 too.
And if I'm going to give it a grade, I echo Ryan's sentiment and give it an A. But Ryan, that brings our first Marvel episode to an end. But the conversation doesn't have to stop because, like I said, we're all, you know, in a state of self isolation. So
there's not much that any of us can do, right?
But, so if people want to continue talking about Iron Man and the MCU with you, outside of the podcast realm, where can they do that?
You can find me on Twitter at the Amazing Rye Guy.
Awesome. And if you want to talk to me, you can do so on Twitter at Adam_LeafsFan. You can also head to our Facebook page, which is Multiverse Musing Podcast Network. You can ask for acceptance into the group, and either Travis, Ryan, or myself will happily add you there, and we can continue a marvelous conversation there in regards to Marvel, or we can venture out into DC, wrestling, the Ninja Turtles, He-Man, whatever you want. It's all there. Just ask me about fashion, because I don't know any of that crap. It's not my cup of tea. But anything else we'll talk about. I look forward to continuing the conversation. Until next time, we hope you had a fantastic time listening to this, just as much fun as Ryan and I had recording this. Until next month, stay safe, and remember that Iron Man is forever, from his first film to his last.
So long, everybody. Take care, everybody.